I don't know what we advertise as far as topic. I think it was just from the rabbi's desk. So that's what I do when I can't think of a topic in advance, and I just like to sort of play it by ear at the end. So what we're going to do is what I do in the normal from the rabbi's desk. Sure, yeah, go ahead. I posed three questions that came up recently, and you'll tell me which one or ones you want to talk about. We have a full hour, from what I'm told, so maybe we'll get to more than one actually this week, which is very exciting. So I'll tell you three questions that came up recently. One question came up recently, I don't know if you heard, but there was a Siyum HaShas recently. So a lot of people have started doing Daf Yomi. I flew to Eretz Yisrael last week. Close to Mamish, the entire plane had a Maseches Brachos out at one point or another. It was so inspiring to see. There was a guy sitting in front of me, no yarmulke, Maseches Brachos in his hand. Unbelievable. Not just like after he woke up and his yarmulke had fallen off, like from the beginning. No yarmulke, Maseches Brachos in his hand. It was Mamish unbelievable. So a lot of people, now they say from Ramesha, I don't know if this is true, but they say that Ramesha said, when they asked Ramesha why it is that when Haskalas Gemara, when kids are in elementary school, they start Gemara, why do they always start with Eilu Metzias? They should start with Brachos. Brachos is much easier, it's much more practical, right? You would think you would start with Brachos. So Ramesha supposedly said, they can't start with Brachos, because if you start with Brachos, these are things that are Nogeya, B'chol Yom V'Yom. Right, so for those of us who are into Daf Yomi coincidences, every day there's that. I said Shema today, and now we're learning about Shema. Every day there's a Daf Yomi coincidence in Maseches Brachos, and a lot of the kids grow up in homes where maybe the people are not, the parents are not so observant of all the halachos as they should be, and then right away at the beginning there's going to be a stira in their education from what they see at home and what they learn in yeshiva. Eilu Metzias is no problem. You know, how often does the parent find whatever Charush Shel Dagim or something that they need to, the chayiv lahachriz or not chayiv lahachriz. You know, it's not something that comes up so often, so it's not something that they're going to see stiras in. But one of the things that we find with Maseches Brachos is that a lot of people who are learning Daf Yomi for the first time start to reassess the way they do things on a daily basis. So I got the following shayla, that's all an introduction. I got the following shayla from a school principal. Part of his job as a school principal, or certainly one of the things he does, is that he goes out every single morning to greet the buses as they come. Right, and he says good morning to each child, and he shakes their hand as they walk into yeshiva. I'm sure as many of you may have seen the video of from the beginning of the school year of Rabbi Bender standing outside the darche, giving each kid a kiss on his head as they walked into yeshiva. So that's part of his job as school principal. Problem is, the guy's learning Daf Yomi and Brachos Daf Yudalid. The Gemara tells us that a person is not supposed to be Nosin Shalom L'Chavero before he's davened, and the principal davens together with the yeshiva. He davens together with the students. So can he be Nosin Shalom L'Chaver before he daven? And the Gemara goes on to say that it's particularly bad, or it's maybe only bad, if he goes out of his way to go and greet them. If he's Mashkim L'Pischem. So over here you have a situation. He's in his office. He could just go straight into the auditorium where they daven and daven with them, but he goes out of his office, Dafka, because the buses are coming now, and he's going out to greet them. So Shaila number one, is the principal allowed to do his job, I guess, right? Is he allowed to do what he does every morning? Shaila number two. There's a guy that called me who worked as a director of a camp for 7 years. He was hired by the camp. The camp, no one else in this camp had any, I think it was a day camp, no one else in this day camp had any clue about social media, about how to develop a social media presence, an Instagram account, a Twitter account, a Facebook page, whatever people have to do now in order to be relevant. And this guy happens to be pretty good with social media. So he started an Instagram account for the camp, and he was the only person that ever posted anything on the Instagram account. But he knew what he was doing, and you know how parents are when kids are at camp. You know, parents, like, I guess they quit their jobs for the summer, and they just look at pictures. They scroll through thousands of pictures. Why is he wearing the same shirt that he wore yesterday? If you work in a camp, these are the calls that they get in the office. Why is my son, why does he have a half a frown on? why is he holding a hot dog? He shouldn't be eating hot dogs. You know, they look through every picture, and they'll have all sorts of kashas. But there are parents that actually pay their children for every picture I see you in, I'll give you a dollar, just to make sure that they can keep tabs of this, so that every time they see a camera, the kid will jump in front of the camera. So anyway, that's beside the point. So this fellow developed an Instagram account, and he did a very, very good job. And the camp now has like close to 1,000 followers on Instagram. I'm not sure if that's good or bad, but it seems like it's pretty good for a small day camp to have close to 1,000 followers on Instagram. Recently, this camp director and the camp had what we would call an unamicable split. He is no longer working for the camp. He is not happy about it, nor is he happy with the way he was treated on the way out. He owns the Instagram account he's the only one that ever posted on the camp's Instagram account. So he wanted to know two things. First, I was wondering if he was going to ask, like, can he post, like, nasty kinds of... But he wanted to know, does he own the account or does the camp own the account? Meaning, he's the one that put all the effort in. It was his own ideas. So does he own the account or does the camp own the account? Can he keep it? Why might he want to keep it? Because he might want to go to a different camp, change the title of the account from camp... I don't know, Yeladim Tovim to Yaldot Tovot or something like that, right? And that way he'll already have a base of 1,000 followers that he built up over time, because he's the one that did all that. So he wanted to know, A, does he own the account? And B, if he doesn't own the account, he has the password. It's connected to his email address, his cell phone, his everything. They're not going to be able to post anything unless they get the password. Does he have to give it to them? He's not happy with them. So is he obligated to give them the password? That is shaila number two. Shaila number three that came up was just this past week. I was in Eretz Yisrael with a group of extraordinary rabbanim, actually. And one of the things that we did, that we had the zuchus to do, was on, I think it was Monday night, we went to Har Nof, and we met with Rav Rubin. Anyone know who Rav Rubin from Har Nof is? Good. He's the author of the Orchos Shabbos. The Orchos Shabbos, if you ever learn Hilchos Shabbos, it's like the go-to sefer. It's what you really need. You know, it's a sefer that you sort of need to have. He goes through the whole sugya, and he goes through what all the contemporary shailas and what all the poskim say. He was a Talmud of Rosh Hashanah Zalman Arbach. He also is known as because he's the Rav of the Shul in Har Nof, where that terrible massacre happened a few years back, 5 years ago. So Rav Rubin is a tremendous, tremendous Talmud Chacham. He's a Talmud of Shlomo Zalman Auerbach. So first we got a tour of the shul, which itself was just like unbelievable. You picture shuls in Eretz Yisrael, Haredi shul in Eretz Yisrael. I pictured like a little hole in the wall kind of place. You know, they were describing people throwing shtenders at the attackers or whatever. I thought they'd be like, I don't know. You go into that shul, it's more magnificent. It's like this, than any shul in the five towns. It's more beautiful than, physically. I'm not talking about spiritually, that too probably. But physically, it's just like this, it's this magnificent, magnificent structure. It's an incredible, incredible shul. They kept, even though it's such a beautiful shul, they kept the bullet holes in the glass doors on the way in. They kept the bullet hole in the paroches. They kept the zecher of what happened there. So anyway, after that, we went to Rav Rubin's house, and Rav Rubin, we had the opportunity from 10:30 at night to like, midnight. We had the opportunity to discuss Hilchos Shabbos with him, some of the more relevant contemporary issues in Hilchos Shabbos. So in the course of the conversation, Rav Rubin mentioned that his Rebbe, Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, held that electricity on Shabbos, use of electricity on Shabbos, not for an incandescent light bulb, but for regular electricity, for a fluorescent light or for something like that, is an Isser Doraisa. So we said, wait, we have a Kasha. What's the Kasha? Rav Shlomo Zalman wrote a whole book. His very first sefer was a book that was dedicated to proving that that is not true, right? That it's only at most an Issa Drabanan, maybe a Minhag, meaning who held that it was an Issa Daraisa every time you use electricity? Chazanish held it's Malacha of Boda, that every time you're building a circuit or whatever, that's the Shitas Chazanish. Rav Shlomo Zalman wrote a whole sefer just to show, when he was very young, when he was like 19 or 20 years old, just to prove that the Chazanish is incorrect, and that it's only in Isser Derabanan. And in fact, Maisim B'chol Yom, probably in many of your shuls, that they have a guy that turns on the air conditioner, turns off the air conditioner, changes the thermostat, turns on the lights, turns off the light. Why? Why do we have a guy? Amir Lakum is an Isser. Why are we allowed to ask a guy to do something like that? What are we relying on? those that that do it. Probably it's gone too far in terms of the way many shuls do it. Someone told me, one of the rabbanim there said that in the shul that he's in, he's not the only rabbi of the shul. He said, a guy comes in the middle of davening and says, is everyone cool over here? Is everyone comfortable? You sure you don't have it? Like mamash, right? Right in the middle of davening. I could raise it a few degrees lower. So that's obviously not such a great situation. But what are we relying on when we do that? What we're relying on is shvus to shvus b'makom mitzvah. Why is it a shvus to shvus? Amir la'akum is one shvus, and we assume that whatever he's doing with the thermostat and whatever he's doing with the light is only nisr drabanan. So we said, what are you talking about? How could you say it's a nisr, more respectfully than that, but how could you say that Rosh Hashanah held was a nisr daraisa? He said, I know what Rosh Hashanah wrote. This is how he paskined. This is what he held. This is what he paskined. So which led us to the question, and this is question number 3, what do you do when the Mincha Shlomo disagrees with the Baal HaMincha Shlomo? And not just Rosh Hashanah Zalman, but you have this in all over the place. What do you do when the Igros Moshe disagrees with Rosh Moshe Feinstein? Who do you trust? What do you do when the Kovitz Shuvas disagrees with Rav Eliashib? Right? Who do you trust? Do you trust what we know they actually paskin? Or do you trust what's actually written in the Sefer? How are we to... So it's more of like a general kind of question. It's not like a specific shayla. But it's very relevant to a lot of different things that are very nogeya lemaisa. So that is question number 3. Okay, so we probably won't get to all 3 of them, but we probably will get to 2 of them. So what were the questions? Principal saying good morning to the kids, the Instagram account, and what do you do when the Baal Igros Moshe disagrees with the Igros Moshe?
All the shows nowadays, we rely on the Rosh Hashanah.
I think so. I think that's what they're relying on. Right? I assume so. So, any preference? Which shall I do first?
Vote.
Yeah, we're going to vote. All those in favor of question number 1? As I suspected. All those in favor of question number 2? Okay, a little more. All those in favor of question number 3? Okay, I wasn't counting, but it looks like 3 and 2 are close to each other. So we'll probably do... let's start with 3 and then we'll go back to 2. Yeah? Okay, so we'll start with what we do when there's a machlokas between the author of a sefer and the sefer itself. So first of all, just some examples of this. There are probably many examples, and probably if the shir gets put online, I'll get lots of emails with a lot of other, and I would welcome them. It's a great shavuos topic, by the way, to examples where the author disagrees with the sefer. So one example I came across, I happen to be learning Hilchas Nida, teaching Hilchas Nida this year. So one example I came across is the Gemara Maseches Nida, Daf Nun Tes Amud Beis, tells us that Kol Davar Sheino Mekabel Tumah Zeino Mekabel Ksamin. That normally there's a din midrabanan that if a woman finds a stain of blood, even though she didn't have a hargasha and it wasn't a regular flow of blood, just a stain of blood on a garment, the halacha is midrabanan that she's tamei. But the Gemara Maseches Nida tells us it depends where she found the stain. If she found the stain on something that's not Mekabel Tumah, then she's not going to be tamei. Then we're not going to be gozer the din of ksamim. So it turns out this is one of the areas in halacha where even bismaneinu, even with bisman shein bismikshkayim, a person needs to know tumah and tahara, just to know what is and what is not mekabel tumah, because it's going to have big nafkaminas when it comes to being matirisha lebaila. Like for example, if a woman finds a stain on a toilet bowl or a toilet seat, is that mekabel tumah? So you have to know a little bit about tumah and tahara, right? So is it mekabel tumah? Well, it's mechubel lekarka. That which is mechubel lekarka is kekarka dami karka. Not mekabel tumah. Oh, but what if it was a porta potty, right? So maybe that's a different story. I always tell Chassan, but if you have a shayla where your wife was on a porta potty and she found some dam, you need to do a whole cheshbon hanefesh about like what kind of decisions you've been making in life that brought her to a porta potty. But but generally speaking, it's a serious shayla. So there is a shayla that's discussed in poskim about paper. Is paper mekabel tumah or is it not mekabel tumah? So piskei tshuva kotzer min adi bihuda tinyana yerdeasim kofei that our papers are mekabel tumah. The Rambam in Kelim Perek Beis says that they're not. In fact, the Gilui Marsha understands that when the Shach comments in Simkov Pei Tes, that Ayin Baramam Hilchos Kelim Ma'hin Advarim Shehein Mekabel Tumah, he's specifically referring to Niyar, meaning that he's trying to draw your attention to the fact that the Rambam Dafka holds that papers are not Mekabel Tumah. So Pesach Tshuva quotes that Nadbida says, "No, I'm not against the Rambam. It all depends how the paper is made," and he gets into a lot of details. So why would this matter to us whether papers and Mekabel or not, how often is a stain found on paper? like on paper, right? How often does that happen? How would that leave a blood stain found on paper? So why is this nogea?
You can make garments out of paper.
What?
Because you can make the garment out of it.
You can make a garment out of paper? That's not really it. We don't have so many garments made out of paper. Toilet paper, right? A very common place to find a stain is on toilet paper. So is toilet paper mekabel tuma or not? Now, it happens to be that with toilet paper, there's a whole bunch of other issues, you know, that can come up. So when you do learn, I assume most people here are not married. So when you do learn the inyan, you have to, you know, deal with potential hargasha issues. Again, if you're not in the sugya, you know, you'll get there, or you have to deal with if she pressed the tissue against her body, and whether it could be mekel pachs, mekel gris, and the fact that she's holding it, maybe that's something that's mekabel tum is holding the paper, makes it worse, and you know, you have to deal with a stain that's wiped straight from the body, maybe as a din of a stain that's found on the body. Okay, all of these things. But bottom line is, Rav Moshe has a tshuva, where Rav Moshe discusses toilet paper, and Rav Moshe is maker. In Igros Moshe, he says that toilet paper is not mekabel tuma. He says, really, paper is mekabel tuma. Regular paper is mekabel tuma, but our tissues are so thin, they're no longer mekabel tuma, because it's not washable like normal fabrics. Meaning, apparently, after it's dirty, you can't wash it off, and therefore, it's not mekabel tuma. That's the sheet of Rav Moshe. That's explicit in Igros Moshe. Rav Moshe has a very great Talmud who lives in Chicago by the name of Rabbi Shmuel First, and he's a big posek in Chicago. And I was listening in the car recently to some of Rabbi First has Hilchos Nida Review Shiurim. So I was listening to them. Fascinating. That's not what they were called. They were called Hilchos Nida Psakim from Rav Eliashiv. Because Rav First apparently spent an entire summer or a year by Rav Eliashiv learning Nida and getting all of his Pesachim and Hilchos Nida. So it was very fascinating, a lot of interesting things that came up, but he can't help himself. He can't only say Piskei Halacha that he got from Rav Eliashiv. He's a Talmud of Rav Moshe. So every time, it was really, the proper title would have been where Rav Eliashiv and Rav Moshe differ on Hilchos Nida, because that's where he was really going with most things. So one of the things he mentioned was that Rav Moshe held that toilet paper is Mekabel Tuma, and therefore it's Mekabel Ksamim, and you need to ask Shailas about stains that are found on toilet paper. What? Ramesh is he's the one we rely on, right? Everyone is makel in this country, as far as I know, everyone is makel on toilet paper. Because Ramesh writes in the Tshuva, Ramesh, we don't know Tomentara. Ramesh knows Tomentara. We had one Jew who knew Tomentara, who was able to pass me these shilas for us. And it's a long, long discussion. He's makel. Rabbi First says, Kiseder, women would bring him shilas on toilet paper. He would look at them and pass for them, and he would not just say, it's toilet paper, don't worry about it. And he would pass in Lechumra sometimes. So he really held this way. So right away, I had one of the Talmidim, who's close with Rabbi Tendler, ask Rabbi Tendler. He said, yeah, it's taka true. that's what he did. Rabbi First said that he asked Rabbi Moshe, when the tshuva came out, he was surprised, because the tshuva was makel. So, and he knew Rabbi Moshe was always machmir. And Rabbi Moshe said, yeah, you should be machmir. What did you write in the tshuva? So what do you do with that? Right? That's one example. Another example is Rav Shlomo Zalman and electricity, like we just said. Rav Rubin is one of the most trustworthy Talmidim, Rav Shlomo Zalman. He went to Rav Asher Weiss, he said, Rav Rubin is, you know, he's an Adam Gadol, and he's absolutely very close Talmud Rav Shlomo Zalman, and you have to trust him when he says that Rav Shlomo Zalman held something. Rav Rubin even went so far as to say that one time the lights in the mikveh were out in Har Nov on a Friday night. Fluorescent bulbs, not incandescent bulbs. I understand the difference in incandescent bulbs, the old fashioned light, but you can't even find them anymore. Probably on Amazon or whatever, you can find someone who's selling them, you know. But the old fashioned incandescent bulbs had a din of H, right? Because they're heat emitting and has a wick sort of inside the candle, inside the bulb. But all of our fancy new lighting does not have a din of H. Right, so the old-fashioned incandescent bulbs are definitely in this daraisa. They say Ruchai Meizi used to say Avdallah and make a Bore Morei Eish in the old-fashioned incandescent bulbs. That's what the poskim will tell you, that if you go away to a hotel and you have to light Neros Shabbos, right, so what the poskim tell you? So it's illegal, they're not going to let you light the candles in the room, usually. It's not always true, by the way. I have a Talmud who got married this year on Hanukkah, and his only way to light Ner Hanukkah was going to be, because a guy who gets married on Hanukkah, on that night that he gets married, is essentially homeless, right? Because he's moved out of his parents' home, he has not yet moved into his apartment, and he's on that one day in between. So what does a homeless person do on Hanukkah? So wherever he's sleeping that night, that's where his mitzvah is for Neros Hanukkah. So he called up three or four different hotels to ask where if he's allowed to light candles, and whichever one said yes, that's where he booked the room for that night. But most hotels would not allow you to light in the room. So what do poskim generally tell you to do? They say find an incandescent bulb, and you can make a bracha on that, light that in your room, turn on the incandescent bulb in your room for Neros Shabbos. But in the dining area, they have set up like off to the side in a room that nobody ever goes to, and you know, an area that no one ever uses, like 1,000 candles that you could light the tea light over there. So why don't you use that? Because that's a bracha levatala, right? That's not the mitzvah. It's not providing you any light. So maybe on your table, some people say that if they allow you to bring on the table that you eat on, you could light. But the old fashioned incandescent bulbs were the best eitz. The problem is impossible to find. There's an organization in Eretz Yisrael called Machon Tzomet, where they develop technological advances or things that help out as far as technology is concerned. So half of what they do is that they try to develop advances. And the other half of what they do is that they try to, like, go back in time, go into a time machine and go back 50 years ago, and that way we can go back to not having these shaylas. So one of the things that they developed is a little thing that has two incandescent bulbs and a battery. It's battery powered. So for those who hold that a ner has to be something that all the shemen is there on the spot, so it would fulfill that requirement. And it's two incandescent bulbs, which you can't find anywhere, and it fits into this little white base, and it says in front of it, Lekavit Shabbos Kodesh, and you could use that as your Shabbos candles. And they dafka wired it in such a way that it should be so inefficient that it should drain the entire battery in like 3 or 4 hours. Why? Because if you have it in a hotel room, you're going to want to go to sleep after a while, and it's going to light up your whole hotel room. So it drains the entire battery, so it will go dark, and then you'll be able to go to sleep. Brilliant. So it's just like Shabbos candles. So Rabbi Rubin actually had one of those things with him, and he said, look at this. He said, people are putting this on their tables at the hotel. And he said, I hold, if you put it on the table where you eat in the ballroom at the hotel, it's a bracha levatala. That you're not allowed to do that. So he said, why? So Rav Shechter would say it's bracha levatala anyway, even to light candles probably on the table at the hotel, because Shraga Batir and Mayahani, the whole room is lit up anyway. You're not adding any light. But most poskim would allow lighting candles on your table where you eat. He said, no, you know why we allow lighting candles on a table where you eat at a hotel? Is because the candles are dafka l'kavod Shabbos. They're a symbol of kavod Shabbos. But these aren't candles, these are light bulbs. So they're not a symbol of kavod Shabbos. So mela, it doesn't help to light them on the table. So I said to him, but look, it says l'kavod Shabbos kodesh right in the front, right? I could say it's not a symbol of kavod Shabbos. But anyway, Rubin also held that lighting in your hotel room is a very good eitzah. It's a good thing to have. How do we get to? Yeah, so going back to the electricity issue. So Rav Rubin told us that in Har Nof once the lights were out in the mikvah on Friday night. So what do you do in that situation? You get a guy to turn the lights on, right? Shvus to shvus, b'makom mitzvah. Is there a makom mitzvah greater than that? That a woman should be able to be tovel on her lel tevila, right? So of course you would do that. He said, nope, Shlomo Zalman held turning on lights is nisadar raisa. The mikvah was closed that Friday night. Wow, so this is not stam chumrah. This is something that he apparently really held. What do you do with that? Rosh Hashanah wrote a whole sefer that it's a nisr, that it's only a nisr d'rabbanan at most, and that it's not a nisr d'oraisa. So the whole world relies on that. So what do you do with that situation? So those are two examples. There's a third example. Rabbi Isaac Rice pointed out to me that the Mishnah Brura says when it comes to saying a bracha rishona on dessert, right, so do you recite a bracha when you're eating dessert at a meal? So Mishnah Berurah says like a fruit-filled pie, like real pasabah b'kisnit, that has a pocket and it has something sweet inside the pocket, that you would say a bracha, but most regular cakes you would not. And in Tshuvos van Hagos, Rav Sturmbach says that's what the Mishnah Berurah says. But the author of the Mishnah Berurah says differently. The Chafetz Chaim, Yisrael Meir Cohen, says differently. He says that no bracha is required on dessert. In fact, Rabbi Forst, in his Hilchos Brachos Sefer, quotes a rumor that the Chafetz Chaim said that in America, desserts are part of a meal, and in America, you don't say a bracha on desserts. But he says in Mishnah Berurah that you do. So Rabbi Forrest says these are, he does not put the Tshuvos HaNagos. He just says there's a rumor, right? A rumor that that the Chafetz Chaim said this. And Rabbi Forrest immediately dismisses it. He says it's a false rumor, fake news. Why? Because the Shaar HaTzion in Siman Kuf Ayin Zayin, Sifkat Meches, writes, Va'af b'mekomos shenagu lechol peros mevu shalom b'kol su'udah l'besof. And even in places where they always have dessert, like in America, Gamkin Mistavra Lakhara Delo Khashivi Kidvarma Ba Mahmasuda. It's still Mistavra that it's not considered something about Mahmasuda Kim Shal Kalpanim Rakli Kinuachim Baim Velo Lafis Apas. The Gam Lola Mazan Lusova. Because they're only there for kinuach. They're only there to cleanse the palate after the meal. They're not really there to satiate you, to nourish you in any way. And therefore, it's something that would require a bracha. So you see, the Mishnah Berurah deals with it directly. What happens if you have a place where there's always dessert? And he does not say, it's just part of the meal. It's covered in the bracha. No, he says you still have to say a bracha on it. So to suggest, says Rabbi Forrest, that the Mishnah Berurah held that in America, because we always have dessert, that it becomes part of the meal, and therefore doesn't require a bracha, totally incorrect. But Rav Sternbach says it's yadua that the Chafetz Chaim held this way, that the Chafetz Chaim, forget about America, that he changed his mind about brachas on desserts. So what do you do when the posek achron for much of Ashkenazic Jewry, the Chafetz Chaim in the Mishnah Berurah, says one way, and he himself apparently, according to Rav Sternbach, did otherwise? Yeah, so these are three examples. I'm sure you could think of many others. Can anyone think of others where Poskim said one thing and wrote something else? Huh? Yeah, so, okay. You rack your brains, you think of something. Yeah? Asking Mechil about Lashon Hara, asking Machlokas Chafetz Chaim in Yerushalayim Salanti.
Apparently he said something different than Sefer and then the Mishnah Berurah. And Sefer from the Simon.
And the Sefer Chafetz Chaim in Mishnah Berurah. I'm not familiar. I know that it was Machlok Chafetz Chaim and Yisrael Salanter. I didn't realize that. Okay. So that's a stira within two things that he wrote. Over here we're dealing a little different. Something that he published versus something that everyone knows he said. Or Edim Ne'amanim tell us that he said. So we asked the Shaila to a few people. We had the opportunity to meet with Rav Yitzchak Zilberstein last week. Rav Yitzchak Zilberstein is Rav Eliashiv's son-in-law. And he's the author of all those funny svarim. You know, Cheshukei Chemed and Varevna, all those svarim that have all those funny shailas and funny answers. So he's also the author of a sefer called Torah Seyoledes, which was the book on halachas of childbirth. It still is, meaning it's a very, very valuable resource for the halachas of childbirth and pregnancy. I think that was his first sefer. Like, that's when he was, you know, he wrote it all. Like, it wasn't, now he has a team of people that are writing all these funny shailas that come in, and it's very popular because people always enjoy these funny kinds of questions. Rav Zilberstein told us, first of all, he said, there's no shaila over here. If someone puts something in print, you trust the printed word, you don't trust anything else. And then he told us a story where he did the exact opposite. So what was the story where he did the exact opposite? He said that in his sefer, Torah Seyoledes, if you look there, it says that a husband is not allowed to go into the delivery room with his wife when his wife is having a baby. And v'chein pasak ha'goyin Ramesha Feinstein. The Ramesha said that a husband is not allowed to go into the delivery room when his wife is having a baby. So let me read to you what it says in Igros Moshe. Yerodei Chelik Bey Simen Ayin Hey. As far as the issue of whether the husband's allowed to be there to make sure everything goes right, and to provide encouragement to his wife, and or to cry in a corner out of terror, which is what usually happens, he says, if there's some need for this, I don't see any iser. And even if there's no need for it, I don't see any iser. He can't be looking, you know, he shouldn't be taking videos as the baby's coming out, right? He shouldn't be mistakel as the baby's coming out, mamish. Because there's a halacha that a husband's not allowed to look at the parts of his wife's body that are normally covered while she's a nida. And while she's in that stage of childbirth, she's obviously, clearly, a nida already. So he's not allowed to do that, but to stand next to her head and to talk to her and to encourage her and do things like that. Of course that's mutter, says Ramesha. What would the yisr be? Minchas Yitzchak in Chel Chesem and Lamed Os Beis disagrees. He says Bebeis Hachol Mishari Tzedekan Kasher Shalav Osiyal Zeh Amarti Lesar Zulas Im Yesh Chashash Sakana. He says unless it's Chashash Sakana, I assert it in Shari Tzedek. Minchas Yitzchak, I guess, was the Rav of Shari Tzedek before Rav Asher Weiss. No, the Tzitz Eliezer was before Rav Asher Weiss. Maybe Minchas Yitzchak was before the Tzitz Eliezer. I don't know. I think the policy has changed in Shari Tzedek, someone told me. And now they do allow the husbands to go into the delivery room. But it used to be, apparently, in Shari Tzedek, when Minchas Yitzchak was in charge, they didn't allow it. Now there's a new sheriff in town, I guess. So, but Rav Asher Weiss is the posik for Shari Tzedek. One thing we learned over the past week, being with Rav Asher Weiss a lot, is that he's the posik for everything. Like, the country would fall apart without him. He's the posting for Shari Tzedek and for the police force and for the Mossad and for Tzahal. Like, the whole country would just like fall apart. It's crazy. So Tzahal has a number of rabbanim that they consult with, all Haredi, interestingly. But what was I saying? Yeah, so Minchas Yitzchak is machmir in this issue. But Beferish, Rav Moshe, it's not even like Rav Moshe, you know, leaves some room for interpretation, right? Rav Moshe says, if there's a tzorech, I don't see an iser. Va'af below tzorech, eini roe iser. Like, that's a very, very explicit lashon. That even without a tzorech, I don't see any iser b'davar. So Zilberstein said, why did he write in Torah Se'eledes, or Rav Moshe asked, was going into the delivery room? Because he spoke it over with his father-in-law, with Rav Eliashiv. And Rav Eliashiv said it's impossible that Rav Moshe would allow such a thing. He must have only been talking to special tzaddikim or something that know for sure that they're not going to be mistaken. So he said. So I could write that Rav Moshe holds that it's awesome. He says, yeah, you can write that Rav Moshe holds that it's awesome. But Rav Moshe gets a vote in what Rav Moshe holds. No, so Rav Moshe didn't hold it was us. Rav Moshe, I found that so unusual. Meaning, you don't have to quote Rav Moshe; just quote Rav Eliashiv. Leave Rav Moshe out of it, right? You don't. Why do you have to quote Rav Moshe? But he quoted Rav Moshe. Okay. So Rav Zilberstein said, I must have gotten 100 letters from people telling me that I was wrong, and I had to sit there answering each one that no, I'm right, because Rav Eliashiv told me. He said, I couldn't even answer all of them. My hand fell off from writing so much. Because he was wrong. Obviously he was wrong. Right? So strange. I don't know. But so that's one mahalich. That's Rav Zilberstein's mahalich, is that if Rav Eliashiv told you that it's impossible that he could have held what he actually held, then you can rely on that. But that's an unusual mahalich. We asked Rav Asher Weiss about this, and Rav Asher Weiss said that when a gadol signs off on the publication of a psak, it's meaningful. Meaning when he's willing to go to print with publishing a psak, then that's meaningful for everybody. Meaning he's putting that into the system. When a gadol paskins off the cuff, for someone, for an individual, not as meaningful. Even though you trust the individual and you believe that's what he said, but the gadol's not putting that into the system of the library of Jewish literature that we're going to consult when determining halacha for future generations. In fact, Rav Asher said that he's not really sure why they're publishing all these psakim of Rav Moshe Feinstein at this point. I mean, Igros Moshe is pretty much finished, right? They say they may have another volume down the pipes, but it's pretty much finished. So what are they publishing? Mesoros Moshe. You've seen Mesoros Moshe? Right, so what's Mesoros Moshe? A number of psakim that Rav Moshe gave Baal Peh. There's three volumes already of Mesoros Moshe. So Rav Asher said, well, I don't get to decide whether they publish Mesoros Moshe or not. Rav David Feinstein is alive, and he wrote that he supports the idea of publishing the Mesoros Moshe. Rav David signed off on it, but Rav David writes, but it's not halacha l'maisa. Not to be taken, meaning it's not like learning in Igros Moshe. Why is it not halacha l'maisa? Because these are psakim that were given to individuals. Rav Asher pointed out that it's strange to say it's not halacha l'maisa. Not strange, but it's maybe wishful thinking to say that it's not halacha l'maisa, because the difference between reading Igros Moshe and Mesoros Moshe is like the difference between reading Eretz HaTzvi and Nefesh HaRav. Right? Meaning, are you familiar with these svarim? Written by someone who sits not so far from you? Eretz HaTzvi is like a serious sefer. Like, you need to really focus and understand and look up the Makoros, because a lot of times it's just a fleeting reference and Rav Shechter is assuming an understanding of the whole sugya. And Nefesh HaRav is like a storybook. You could read it while you're going to sleep at night. It's like anyone, as long as you speak Hebrew, you could read Nefesh HaRav and you could understand it. Right? So who's going to read Mesoros Moshe? Anyone, any Amaretz could read Mesoros Moshe. So as much as you say it's not halacha l'maisa, it becomes more halacha l'maisa than Igros Moshe. Because Igros Moshe, most people can't read. Especially Ramesha wrote, and Ramesha was not the clearest of writers. He very often had like sentences with like 8 qualifiers. You know, like you have to like really. He wrote it in that kind of way, but in the Soros Moshe, everything's super duper clear. Second of all, when someone Dafka didn't publish something, very often there's a reason they didn't publish. Even if they wrote it, there's very often a reason they didn't publish it. Rav Shachter told us once, I think we were at his house on Chanukah once, like 20 years ago, whatever. He told us that if you find writings of mine in my desk, you know, Lachar Meyav Esrim Shana, don't publish them. There's a reason that I didn't publish them. But that's also something to consider. You know, when it comes to Avil Yashiv, it's even more complicated. The Mipia Shmuel Pesachim you hear from Avil Yashiv, most people who are in the know will tell you are worth about nothing, because everyone's got an agenda. Everyone's trying to control what Rav Yashiv. Rav Asher told us that which Rav Efrati says in the name of Rav Yashiv you can trust, because Rav Efrati was mamish lo zazi yado mitoch yado, and he has no political agenda. He says, I don't know if I trust anybody else, but Frati you could trust. But there were so many people around Rav Yashiv that were trying to push whatever they were trying to push. And in addition to that, the volumes of Kovitz Tshuvas aren't really Rav Yashiv, meaning he wrote them, he wrote individual Tshuvas, but he never published them. They published it during his lifetime without his permission. This is not me making this up. If you read the book Hashakdan, 3 volumes. Anyone ever hear the book Hashakdan? They put out a biography of Rav Yashiv in Hebrew, and it's based on that art school did their biography of Rav Yashiv. Remember one Tisha B'Av, I got a call like Erev Tisha B'Av from Rabbi Willig, and he said, can you send me, someone's going from Keli to Marsha Kolel, if you have Hashakdan, can you send it to me? Because that's what Rabbi Willig does in Tisha B'Av when he can't learn. He reads Gadol biographies. So I sent him Hashakdan. Someone sent me a picture this morning. They were on the flight with Rabbi Willig, and he was waiting for his luggage at the carousel, and you see him there with the Gemara as he's waiting for his luggage. So whenever he can learn, he's learning. On Tisha B'Av, he can't learn, so he read Hashakdan. Then when I got the book, my wife saw the book. She's like, how awful is that? They call the book that? You know, how terrible. A chutzpah. Like, what are you talking about? Like, Hashakran? They're accusing me. No, it's Hashakdan. It's not Hashakran. So in the biography, in the official biography of Rav Yashiv, it said, the family-approved biography, it says that the family grandchildren published the tshuvas, and they came in and said, Mazel Tov, in the publication of your sefer. He said, what sefer? He had no interest in publishing tshuvas. He never signed off on having those tshuvas published. So with Rav Yashiv, it's very, very different. Rav Shechter once pointed out that Rav Yashiv's derech changed when he stopped working for the Medina, when he stopped working for the Rabbanut, that his whole derech and psak changed, because now he had to give psakim that applied, because previously he had to give psakim that applied to everybody, and once he was no longer working for the Rabbanut, his psakim were for a narrow segment of the community, a never expanding segment, but you know, essentially only the Haredi community, and therefore his derech psak changed based on that. Rav Asher Weiss didn't buy that. He doesn't think that that's correct. He thinks that that's a nice limud zchus. He says, more likely, like most people, he evolved. People evolve over time. So, of course, his derech hapsak changed, because he got older, and he changed, and his influences changed. And, you know, the way he thought about things changed. So, of course, Rav Yashiv changed. Who discovered Rav Yashiv? Who was the one that first discovered that Rav Yashiv was Nadim Gadol, and that we should use his utilize his talents?
Shach.
What?
Shach.
So, Rav Asher said Rav Herzog. Rav Herzog is the one that discovered Rav Yashiv. He said that Rav Herzog... there are tshuvas in the Kovitz tshuvas that are written to Rav Herzog, and they say like Dear Rabbi, but those same tshuvas are also published in Rav Herzog Sefer in Hechel Yitzchak, and it's and with how it was actually written, L'chvod, Hagon, Hagadol, Rabban Shel Yisrael, you know, like with all these honorifics, but it was politically incorrect to have that in Kovitz tshuvas, so they took that out of the Kovitz tshuvas version, and they marginalized Rav Herzog as much as they could. But that's Rav Herzog is one that encouraged Rav Yashiv to write tshuvas in Eben Ezer, because he was really good. He wrote his best tshuvas are in Eben Ezer. Most of the other tshuvas and Kovitz tshuvas are not like, it's not like an Igros Moshe that requires limud and is meant to go down in history as a major tshuva sefer. He was Rav Yashiv was a Talmud of just nobody. A lot of great people had no rebbeim. their minds were just, if you read the Rav Eliyahu biography, three volumes, I could summarize in one sentence. He was 6 years old, he sat down to learn. At 106, he died. That's it. Meaning he just learned for 100 years. And his kids were born, he was learning. relatives got married, he was learning. This one got sick, he was learning. He was learning for 100 years. Unbelievable. Unbelievable. Yeah. So people are allowed to evolve, right? That's for sure. They can change a psak. Rav Zilberstein told us he finds it unconscionable for someone to change a psak and not let the world know in writing. Meaning, in later editions of Igros Moshe, why didn't he change it? Why didn't he publish a later tshuva in the later volumes? He did that a few times, right? Right, in those situations, not a question. So then the question becomes, like you have steers in different svarim of the Rambam that he wrote earlier and later, between the Pirush HaMishnayos and the Mishnah Torah, or things like that. So then the question is, if the Rambam changes mind from what he wrote in the Pirush HaMishnayos to what he writes in Mishnah Torah, Rav Shach has an example of this by Charoses, right? It's Machlokes Tanaim whether Charoses is a mitzvah. So the Rambam writes that Charoses is not a mitzvah because if it were, we pass it's not a mitzvah, because if it were a mitzvah, you'd have to say a bracha, alechilas charoses, so we don't have such a bracha, alechilas charoses, right? Yet in Mishnah Torah, the Rambam passes charoses is a mitzvah, but nothing but a bracha, no bracha on charoses. So he obviously changed his mind. Rav Shach has all Shtikul Torah about what changed in his mind, right? Why does he think now that charoses is a mitzvah, but it doesn't require a bracha? So he said that there's no ma'isa mitzvah. The mitzvah is not to eat charoses, not a mitzvah of achilas charoses, a mitzvah to have it on the table. And that's why the Rambam Dafka highlights that point, that mevim el shulchan, that it's there as a symbol on the table. So it's not a mitzvah of achila b'kezayis. You know, you don't have a din of kezayis of charoses. But in Pirush HaMishnayos, you assume that you do have a din of kezayis by charoses. So that's the question. Do you assume that both are valid shittos? Because the Rambam, when he was younger, was also the Rambam. He just maybe changed his mind when he got older. Do you say no? If that's the only shita, and he changed his mind, so then you have to go with what he said later on. That's an interesting question. If you a lot of times people talk about Rav Eliyahu, they say his Rebbe was Rav Zelig Benges, Rav Reuven Zelig Benges. You know who Rav Zelig Benges was? He was the Eid Haredes. He was the Gaivit of the Eid Haredes. He was a very very chashuv Talmud Chacham, a super genius. They say that when they were learning in, what was it, Slabatka, that everyone was, people got different titles. You could be an Eloi, you could be a Chatzi Eloi, you could be a quarter Eloi, or you could stand to just be a regular person. So like Rav Zal Meltzer was a Chatzi Eloi, you know. Rav Benges was an Eloi. Like Rav Benges was, his great-grandson is probably more well-known to you. He was named after him, Rav Reuven Zelig Tarragon. His great-grandson of Zelig Benges. Anyway. But Rav Eliyashiv wasn't a Talmud of Rav Benges. Rav Benges didn't have Talmidim, and Rav Eliyashiv didn't have a Rebbe. You know, it's just that it's people want to associate. Okay, anyway, the Chazanish never wrote tshuvos. And this also relates to how to view things that change. Chazanish never wrote tshuvos. Why did Chazanish never write tshuvos? This Rav Asher Weiss told us all of this last week in response to this question. So Chazanish never wrote tshuvos because he said that when he wrote something, and this is like should really resonate with you, he said he was b'shai ha'iyun. He was mamish like in the depth of the sugya when he wrote something. So tshuva, when you write a tshuva, you're responding to someone else's agenda. Meaning, it's not what you're learning; it's what someone asked you about. So even if you're going to research the sugya again, and you'll come up with the tshuva. You're not mamish, like, if you're learning chulin this year, and you're like living and breathing chulin, yomam v'layla, so when you have a chiddush in chulin, like it's based in chulin. If in 10 years from now someone comes and asks you a question, chulin, yeah, I could find my way through, I could write a tshuva through it. But it's not the same. It's not the same as when you're mamish in it. They say that Chazanish used to say, that if he would give an answer to someone's question, then he would look it up in his own sefer in Chazanish, and he would find that in Chazanish he says differently than what he answered, even though he has no idea why he wrote what he wrote in Chazanish, he'd pass him like what it says in Chazanish. Because he knew that that's when he was really in it, that's when he was really holding. So if you just apply that, Kal v'chomer, that which is said Balpe is different than that which is written B'Ksav. You know, Rav Asher Weiss coined the term Piskei Chedra Madrigot. What's Piskei Chedra Madrigot? You know, you're going up the stairs to your apartment, and people are peppering Rav Eliyashiv with questions. So he's answering here, there. That's not being in the sugya. He's Rav Eliyashiv. He knows Kol HaTorah Kula. Of course he does. Of course he does. But it's still even the Chazon Ish. It's not the same as mamish being in the sugya, and therefore you rely on the written word much more. A lot of times people will say svaras, and they're not really meaningful svaras, and certainly not svaras that are worthy of printing. Rav Asher told us a svara he came across in a sefer from Dayan from Kelm from 200 years ago. That there was a maisu, there was a shul on Friday night, there was a non-Jewish cholash yishbo sakana, and the non-Jewish doctor was busy, and they asked the Jewish doctor if he can go be mechal Shabbos to save the non-Jewish cholash yishbo sakana, and he sent a shaila to the Nedib Yudas Beis Din afterwards, and the Nedib Yudas Beis Din, each member of the Beis Din sent a different answer, and one of the svaras that they sent, that this guy reports, is that an ani is chashuv kameis, and the doctor is going to lose his job if he doesn't respond to this call. So since Nani Yitzchash of Kameis, it's Pikoach Nefesh. So Rav Asher said, I'm embarrassed to even repeat such a svara. Right? I mean, that's not. So sometimes people will say a svara, they'll just throw something out there, but he would never print such a svara. Tom Chacham would never print such a svara. So you can't just trust whatever people say that someone said when it was actually in print. And two last points to make over here. One is that posts can very often answer differently to different people. That's something to be aware of. That's why they say Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky never wanted to publish tshuvos, and he never did, because they said kaseder. People would come in and ask him the same question, one person after the other, and one person would get one answer, the other person would get the other answer, because he didn't just paskin the shayla, he paskin the person. Rav Eliyashiv was known to paskin the shayla, and that's why how you formulate the shayla mattered a great deal. Because he wasn't paskening the person, he was paskening the exact words that you asked him, and he was very precise in being medayik in the words that you posed him. A lot of times the shoal wasn't precise; they didn't know how to be precise. So that's why Rav Eliyashiv's piskei halacha are much harder to apply to the person. But most poskim pasken the person. They don't. Rav Pam's grandson told me that he used to learn the chavrus with Rav Pam every day. This is a grandson who was a more lebedik personality, so Rav Pam felt he needed to sort of rein him in a little bit, so he used to learn with him the Chavrusa, and he said that when he would read, Rav Pam would yell at him, would reprimand him all the time, that his diktuk is awful, that he was mispronouncing every word, and that he has to really work more in diktuk. Rav Pam was very into diktuk. He used to, so that's why his Talmud, Rav Reisman, if you ever listen to Rav Yisrael Reisman's weekly shiurim, he always starts with a varta based on diktuk. Always. I don't know if he does in his Navi Shir, but in the Parsha Shir that he gives in Tara V'das, that's on the WhatsApp group, he always starts, you know, the first word is always the Diktuk word. Because Rav Pam was crazed about Diktuk. So Binyamin Pam told me he was learning with his grandfather, and a guy comes in, and a guy asks a question about being with Daktek in a word in Kriya Shema. In Kriya Shema. And Rav Pam says, it doesn't matter, however you pronounce it, it's fine. And the guy walks out. His grandson says, "How you pronounce it? It's fine. What are you driving me crazy every single day?" Like, so he said, "That guy." I don't know if Rapam knew the term, but he said that guy has OCD. That guy's going to sit there reading Shema, 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 Shema. You know, he'll drive himself crazy for 25 minutes. So for that guy, you have to say that it's okay and just let it be. Why is it okay? Because I'm Rapam and I say it's okay. And that's it. And that's how you deal with the person who struggles with that issue. But you don't struggle with that issue. You don't care about anything. I want you to pronounce the words properly. So sometimes you have to realize that you're passing the person. Another horror just to make is that sometimes Achrona made mistakes. You know, that it is possible Achrona, even in print, even that which they wrote. So we have to be open to that possibility. Rishonim didn't make mistakes. The Gemara in Erev and Daphne and Gimel tells us that Liban shal Rishonim is kepischo shal Ulam, v'shal Achronim is kepischo shal Heichal. So we normally assume that means that a Rishon's heart is just much broader, bigger than the Achron's heart. The Satmar Rebbe said that the Ulam had no doors. So it was Kepischo Shel Ulam in that everything that went through, there was no slip, there was nothing that got caught. Everything was good. There were no mistakes. It's just our job. When we learn Rishonim, we don't try to figure out if the Rishon is right or wrong. We try to figure out, right? That was Rav Tversky once said that's Reb Chaim's whole derech of learning. Reb Chaim's derech in a sentence is that the Ravid can learn it, right? That's the whole meaning. Everyone else says either the Rambam's right or the Ravid's right. So we got it's all about so prior to Reb Chaim, that's what everyone worked on, proving who's right, who's wrong. So Reb Chaim's whole derech is the Ravid can learn in also. The Ravid knows how to learn. So figure out what he meant. Figure out what, and that's what we do. That's how we do in learning, because that's the status of Rishon. Rav Asher points out there's a famous mistake in Ketzos, the Hilgu Ketzos. There's an obvious mistake in Ketzos. The Ketzos discusses Zechiah, whether Zechiah is mitam Yad or Zechiah is mitam Shlichus, which doesn't make any sense. Zechiah has nothing to do with Yad. He was clearly thinking of Chatz mitam Yad, Chatz mitam Shlichus. Zechiah is not mitam Yad, but sometimes there are mistakes. He said the only Rav Asher, well, only Rav Asher Eskese says in all of the writings of Rabbi Akiva Eiger, he never found a single mistake. He says only one silly thing in his entire writings from Rabbi Akiva Eiger. That's where Rabbi Akiva Eiger discusses the shaila, how a man could be Baal his wife when she's pregnant. Isn't it a violation of Baal Bito? Okay, you know. So he said that's a funny one. But other than that, Rabbi Akiva Eiger doesn't have any upset. But it's very. We have to realize that achronim are human also. Achronim could make mistakes. Although we assume in learning that rishonim, the proper way to learn is to assume that rishonim don't make mistakes. Okay, that's as far as shaila number one. So what do we do? Do we trust the Igros Moshe or the Baal Igros Moshe? We trust the Igros Moshe, not the Baal Igros Moshe, right? We trust what Rabbi Shlomo Zalman said, and that's why it's perfectly fine that we're all makel on toilet paper, and as far as ksavim, and it's perfectly fine that we're all makel to assume that electricity is a drabanan like Rav Shlomo Zalman. It happens in both of those cases. Other postmen held that way also, meaning it's not like you're only relying on Rav Moshe. I remember I once asked Rav Asher Weiss about sanitary pads and whether they're mekabel tumah or not. So Rav Moshe held they're not mekabel tumah, and Rav Asher said also they're not mekabel tumah. He said I'm glad that the world has accepted my psak that they're not mekabel tumah. He's not the only one. A lot of people said that way, that they're not mekabel tumah. It's not always that it's just you relying on that one person. We have a few minutes for the other shayla. Should we get to the other shayla? Yeah, I meant to do half-half. Sorry about that. I got a little carried away there. Okay, so we'll see if we can say something meaningful in 10 minutes. Okay, so the first issue of who owns the Instagram account, so that's obvious. Who owns the Instagram account, the camp or the guy? So this, the L'chora is based purely on Dina Malchus Adina. When you're hired in this country to do something, I once took a tour of Google. So Google has a day, I think it's once a month, that they said, where they tell everyone working for Google, work on whatever interests you. Come up with some new idea and just work on it. And that's how Gmail was invented. Not because some executive at Google said, let's come up with an email platform. It was a day where they just said, think of things, right? So let's say the guy who thought of Gmail wanted to take Gmail and bring it to Yahoo. Does Yahoo still exist? I don't know. Let's say he wanted to bring it to Yahoo. So he's not allowed to do that. Right? Legally, he can't do that. It belongs to Google. It was on his. He was being paid by that company, working for that company, thinking of ideas for that company, and it belongs to them. L'chora, the same is true when it comes to a cat. Yes, there is a major halachic discussion about intellectual property and whether it could really be owned and what the status of intellectual property is, and can you download music and movies and things like that, from the internet. Pashtus is that Dina Malchus Adina applies in these situations, and that it's therefore the property of the camp. The other question is a more interesting question. The question of does he have to give them the password? I found that to be a more interesting question. I think the answer is yes for three reasons. Excuse me. First of all, there's a mitzvah of Hashavas Aveda. It's their password, it's their account, they don't have it. Right? So you have a mitzvah being Meshva Veda. Meshva Veda is only on a physical object. Not true. It's not only on a physical object. Where do we have Hashavas Aveda on something that's not a physical object?
Spiritual.
Huh?
Present spiritual.
Spiritual, good. So the discussion, if you ever look through the sugya of what the mitzvah of doing kiruv is. Right? So the mitzvah of doing halchech tochiach, certainly that, right? In an effective way. So kiruv is that. And it could also be Hashavas Aveda. The person lost their spiritual center. The Gemara in Sanhedrin Daf Ayin Gimel talks about Minay L'Ros Chaveru Shu Tovei Benar Al Chayu Garato Listen Boinu Lav Shu Chayv Latzila. How do I know that if you see someone about to get killed by drowning or by being attacked by a beast or something that you have to save him? Tamalom L'Osam L'Adam Re'echa. Says Gemara V'Hamei Hacha Nafka Me'Hasam Nafka Avedas Gufo Minayin Tamalom V'Shivosilam. Hashavas Aveda, the Gemara says. So what's Hashavas Aveda? What are you returning to the guy? You're returning his life force to him that he's about to lose. That's not a, That's not something that of substance. That's not a tangible thing. But yeah, that's part of the mitzvah of Hashavas Aveda. Second reason I think that he's absolutely obligated to give them the password is Kofen al Midas Sidon. It's a basic idea of Zenen of Zeluchasa, right? It's like by Dina Debar Mitzvah, that if a Bechor gets the Gemara Babas, the Bechor gets Pishnayim, right? He gets double the Yerusha of everybody else. So he gets to demand that his Pishnayim are two fields next to each other. You don't give him a field over here and a field over there, because it's no skin off everybody else's back. What do they care where they get their field? But for him, it's much more convenient to have the two of them next to each other. If a person's selling a field or selling a home or something like that, so you have to first give the right of refusal to the neighbor, because obviously if he wants the field next door, it's going to be more beneficial to him than anybody else. Shulchan Aruch and Chosha Mishpat Paskins in Shin Samach Gimel discusses the dinim of Kofen al Midas Sidon. We don't really have time to get into it. There is a discussion whether I have to let you use something of mine if I'm not using it anyway. Meaning, I'm not going to lose anything. And you could benefit greatly from it, but it's mine, it belongs to me. So that there's a discussion. Normally, the case in the Gemara of Kofen al Midas Sidon is a bedieved situation. You moved into my house and you squatted there. I wasn't around. I own a home in Florida. I happen to not be there. So you moved in for a week, right? And then now the shaila is, do you have to pay me? Right? That's normally the shaila. But the Rama writes in Chosha Mishpat in Reish Samach Gimel that if I have something that belongs to me, but for whatever reason I cannot benefit from it right now and you can, I would be forced to let you benefit from it. I have to let you benefit from it. Wow. Pesachei Tshuva says that is Shitas HaRambam, but we pass like the Rush. Pesachei Tshuva disagrees. If we pass like the Rush, you can never force me to let you use something that's mine. But something that's yours, or something that's not mine, then for sure Kofen al Midas Sidon. So what's this guy going to do with this password? Absolutely Kofen al Midas Sidon. What's he going to do with the password? He's going to change the name on the account and he's going to use it to take all those followers that followed Camp Yeladim Tovim and use it for Yaldot Tovot, right? So that's a third issue. I think that's a violation of Hasagas Kavul. There's a discussion in Gemara Maseches Baba Basra in the second parak, Daf Chaf Aleph, that you're not allowed to spread your net to catch fish in front of your friend's net. The fish are all going toward his net, and you're going to put your net down and you're going to chop all the fish that are really heading toward his net. So there's a discussion. The Rishonim, exactly what are the gedarim of that? So there's a famous shita of the Avi Yosef, quoted by the Mordechai, in the Maseches Baba Basra, that if let's say there's a pizza store in the neighborhood, right? So am I allowed to open another pizza store in the neighborhood that's going to take some customers away? Usually the answer is yes. But says the Avi Yosef, let's say that pizza store is located at the end of a dead end, and I'm going to open up a store closer to the front of the dead end. So anyone who wants to get to that pizza store has to pass by my store first. So he says, that's the net. You're putting a net where all the customers are intending to go. You're chopping them and diverting them from where they would have otherwise gone. You're stealing that person's customers. I would argue the same is true when it comes to to his followers. That the Instagram followers were for that camp. You're now putting out your net to chop them for some other camp or for some other place. That's a direct violation of Hasagas Kavul. And the Tshuva Sarash writes, Chel Gimel, Sim Pei Gimel, you're not allowed to poach somebody else's customers. Aside from the fact that it would probably be annoying for the followers. They want it, they have sons. They wanted to follow Yeladim Tovim. That's where the kids go to camp. They don't want to follow Yeldot Tovot on Instagram. Well, what are they interested in Yeldot Tovot? That's not their camp. So it would seem that this is absolutely the incorrect thing to do. That the right thing to do is to share, give them their Instagram account that they rightfully own, and to give them their password, even though it's somewhat frustrating to this fellow to do that. Okay, shkayach to all of you for learning during Bein HaSemesterim, and continue atzlacha. Question on